This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Beloved brands know customer relationships are everything. That's why over 130,000 trust Klaviyo to power smarter digital relationships across their websites, emails, SMS, and reviews. And now, there's Klaviyo AI, your guide to smarter insights, decisions, work, and results. Brands like Everyman Jack trust Klaviyo AI to personalize product recommendations that keep customers coming back. Discover Klaviyo AI at klaviyo.com/Vox. That's klaviyo.com/Vox.
This is Recode Media with Peter Kafka. That is me. And today I'm talking to no one, or maybe you, the listeners. I'm also talking to Jelani Carter and Travis Larchuk, my producers. Welcome, Jelani and Travis.
Hi,
thanks
Peter.
For having us.
Thank you for having us on the show that we all make.
This is a very special episode of Recode Media. I've wanted to do a mailbag episode forever. I've done this podcast for years. Now we're finally doing it. Thanks to all of you who sent in questions. And if you like this, let me know, because we don't have to do it once a year. We could bring it back periodically. Maybe it's kind of fun. Anything else we should know before we jump into this, Travis?
Jelani and I are going to go back and forth reading the questions that the listeners sent in.
I think everyone who listens to this podcast will understand what we're doing.
No, now, we came up with this format.
Yes. Yeah. No, and Travis is the one who's always telling me that when I'm discussing something with someone and we use jargon or lingo or a concept that maybe isn't familiar to everyone, that we have to stop and explain it or ask the guest to explain it. So that's what we're doing here, to get very, very meta about it. Did I do a good job of explaining the mailbag format, Travis?
You did great. Okay, great. I guess we should explain what mail is and what bags
what bags are. Okay.
So do you want me to kick it off, Travis?
Yeah, go for it.
This is from Allison in Brooklyn. What do you perceive the trajectory to be for Twitter in 2023? I just received a Twitter blue invite and I don't know what that is. How can someone use Twitter without feeling they're betraying their ethical beliefs? Will more people turn to Substack? Do you think Twitter will continue to feel like a party where a few people are left and will eventually make an exit? Is Twitter in hospice? Can it be rebranded?
I did a BBC interview right when Elon Musk was buying Twitter, or officially taking control of it, and the newsreader, they call them, asked me to make a prediction for Twitter, and I said, chaos. And they said, well, can you be more specific? And I said, no, chaos. And I got to say, that was a pretty good prediction, and I think that's going to be where Twitter's at for a while. I think at some point, both our general interest in Twitter and the antics of Elon is going to die down. I think it's already dying down. People are sort of sick of the Trump-like daily provocation that's coming from Elon Musk. I imagine Elon Musk will also tire of provoking people at some point. But I don't think the general contour is going to change, which is that a lot of people who've used Twitter for a long time are going to see less value in it, either because they don't want to be there, they don't support Elon Musk or his politics or anything else he's doing the platform, or frankly, other people have left. And so you have this unvirtuous cycle. I've definitely noticed, and this was happening before Elon Musk took over Twitter, that more and more of the conversations I used to partake in on Twitter were going away. They were well-documented. They go to Discord or newsletters or Substack. And I think a lot of that is going to happen. I don't think there will be a one-for-one Twitter replacement. I don't think anyone's going to build anything like Twitter. Again, the people who built Twitter didn't mean to build Twitter the way they built it. Remember, there was an SMS product that became this thing. And there are very specific use cases for Twitter that I don't think will be replicated anywhere else, and they'll just go away. And I think that's, you know, it will suck for individual people who relied on Twitter to get X or Y. But remember, this is a service that didn't exist until 2006. Most people weren't using it until well into the 2010s. And most internet services have a half-life, and I think Twitter is on the downslope. Is that a fulsome enough answer for that multi-part question?
Peter, what do you make of the ethical side of it, of folks who aren't so into Elon struggling with whether to continue using Twitter or bail out?
I think it's like other high-profile complaints about services people use that are owned by people they dislike, right? Yep. Facebook is one of them. Uber under Travis Kalanick used to be one. And the correct thing to say is that people who are making those complaints, I don't want to be part of this service because this person uses it, are a very, very small and vocal minority. But it can be meaningful, right? It turned out after the fact that Uber really did see a drop in bookings when people were protesting Travis Kalanick during the beginning of the Trump era. Definitely people dislike Facebook and or Mark Zuckerberg, even if they're still using WhatsApp all the time and Instagram all the time. It's a real danger of associating a product with a personality. And no matter what Elon Musk says, Twitter will always be connected to him until he no longer owns it.
I actually have another question going off of this question. Putting the business part of it aside, from a user experience angle, like, what would you change about Twitter to make it like your ideal version of Twitter?
I mean, I've been using it for a long time. I wish that some of the people who were using it when I started using it were still using it. And that's it, because I was there early enough for like you could really actually interact with some of the people you want, in my case, wanted to write about. It was used by tech people and VCs, and they were saying lots of interesting stuff. And eventually they all wised up and left. So it's several iterations of Twitter since then. It's fine. I mean, I think for my purposes, I can use it to say stupid stuff. I try to not do stupid stuff late at night where I can get myself into trouble. I can promote things like this podcast and stories I've written. I'm also very aware that this is not the place that's going to generate the most attention for any of my products. I'm kind of okay with that. It can entertain me or enrage me in equal amounts. And I'm a word person, and it's good for that. I've recently been contemplating, even for this podcast, I tried soliciting reader responses using Instagram, which I've never really done before. And sure enough, people responded right away. Anyway, you were asking me what it would change. I think it's fine. I don't want it to be a video platform. I don't want it to be a payments platform. I want it to be a place where I can type out short messages, people can respond to them, where I can read short messages and news updates. That makes me pretty happy. I can also read what people had for lunch and whether there's an earthquake in San Francisco. What do you guys want in your Twitter?
I just want to say, so the idea of having a 4,000 character limit does not appeal to you at all.
No, that's called a Substack.
I mean, I've been using, I am younger out of the two on this show. I've been using Twitter since I was a sophomore in high school, and it's pretty much been half of my life on Twitter. And it sucks seeing it go in this direction. It seemed like such a crazy downturn. I'm friends with a lot of creators, and like that whole ban on not being able to use outside links to promote your stuff was definitely very crazy, and a lot of my creator friends were hurt by that. I think since then they reneged on that.
He switched it back. Ban lasted less than a day. But there's always going to be crazy stuff going on as long as Elon Musk.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because I've had a few friends that used to do software development on Twitter, and they were saying like this whole process of him just like testing out stuff and taking it away so quickly is kind of unheard of, because they would test out products for months in advance before they would push out, you know, different features. The fact that he's just kind of like A/B testing in real time is very crazy to them, which is pretty insane as a consumer seeing it happen. But I mean, I'm going to ride the wheels until the wheels fall off, but it is a...
You're going to be a dead-ender like me. What about you, Travis? Yeah. You send out the occasional snarky
tweet. I send out the occasional tweet. You know, I think I would prefer if people who incited insurrections could be kept off of the platform.
I agree.
That's pretty much my main beef.
Yeah, that's a fine point. And I will say, as a straight white guy, I don't get harassed on Twitter. I got harassed on Peloton the other day. Peloton was sending out naked lady spam followers. Wow. I'm not the only one. But yeah, my Twitter experience is basic. Like, the only people hurting me on Twitter are myself when I say something stupid. And I realize that's not the same experience for most people. And I do think that Twitter's well-intentioned efforts to clean up the platform have thus have then, well, obviously we know this, have have helped provoke Elon Musk into buying it because he doesn't like them. I think that's a natural tension of any platform. Totally. Okay, that's all our Twitter talk for the day.
Next question.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Edward writes in, there's so much talk about the future of the big entertainment streamers and what the new year holds for them. But what about more niche value add plays like Masterclass? What's the opportunity for these types of channels, and will they increasingly become attractive acquisition targets along the lines of New York Times grabbing The Athletic for its subscriber base and eventual overall contribution to ads and sub retention?
That's an interesting one. I've always been interested in niche products on the internet, niche subscription products more recently on the internet. Substack is a great example of how to get a relatively small number of people, but meaningful enough to create a business, to pay for something they can't get somewhere else or want to support in some reason. Patreon is another version of that that works well for podcasts. It's hard for me to imagine niche subscription video working just because of the cost and difficulty of making good video or video worth paying for. That said, there's tons of people obviously, you know, making stuff that's really interesting all the time on for free on the likes of YouTube and TikTok. So, you know, I don't want to rule that out entirely. I do think it would make perfect sense for a Netflix to buy, say, the library of Masterclass. I think I just saw a tweet about Netflix. See a tweet about Netflix putting up some exercise content, right? This is the kind of stuff you might pay for somewhere else and they're going to bundle it into Netflix. You'll get it. They don't need everyone to watch it. They just need some meaningful number. I think the problem there for the seller is they're not going to get anything close to the value they think they've created with their business, because Netflix is just going to look at it as there's this many hours of content that this many people will watch. We can balance that against whatever we'd pay for documentaries or this many episodes of Friends. It's all the same to us. And there's no extra special sauce there. And so if you're Masterclass, who's not only paid to create all that content to begin with, but has invested in marketing, remember when they were in like every YouTube ad and every Facebook ad to converting those customers, all of that value gets erased. So I can definitely see the Netflixes of the world picking up some of these specialized assets, but I think then they just get chucked into the general sort of swirl of what's available on the platform. So I don't think it's increasingly attractive, I guess, is a double-edged sword. Maybe it's increasingly attractive because it's cheap and easy content for a newly cash-conscious company like Netflix to acquire.
I just imagine doing like a core workout and then an episode of the Great British Baking Show.
Absolutely. You can stack
immediately
them.
Pop sign.
Mm-hmm.
You can stack. I mean, there's no reason not to, right? And Netflix has, you know, like there wasn't a booming market for documentaries until Netflix realized that was something that they could buy really relatively cheaply and that people wanted to watch. And that's, you know, by the way, I think a good thing. You know, stand-up comedy. I'm just repeating stuff I did for my Land of the Giants season a couple years ago. But they certainly have the capacity to find stuff and distribute stuff that seems niche but actually has a bigger audience than you'd think if you can reach 200 million people in one fell swoop like they can.
Next question. This is from Dario in Switzerland. My question relates to old media. I grew up with magazines and newspapers. We as a family invested a significant amount of money every month into print products. Today, that has all changed. The print industry is a pure publishing business and online. I still visit the websites of the same publications, but I don't want to spend money anymore.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Me neither, yeah. Dario. I no longer want to spend money, but please spend money.
Will this industry ever figure out a way to solve this fundamental problem? What is your take? Will maybe a technical standard emerge that finally will solve microtransactions both on desktop and mobile, or will mobile dominate and as Apple/Google taxes everything, this will never happen?
So I took a look at this question in advance. I think what he's saying, and this is something people talk about all the time, I just said I wouldn't talk more about Twitter, but there's something Elon Musk talks about, which is how come people have to pay to read something behind a paywall or subscribe to read something behind a paywall? Why can't they just pay 10 cents or 15 cents or whatever? Mm-hmm. And this is something the industry has been chasing for a long time, because a lot of people feel this way, especially the consumers, right? I don't want to rip off the Washington Post. I think their work is important. I don't want a subscription, but how about 10 cents to read this article? A lot of people on the tech side believe, like Dario, that this is a technical problem, but it's not. It's a business model problem. the publishers in their current incarnation would like you to generate recurring subscription revenue from you. And so they'd rather have one of you pay them X number of dollars a month for a year than a lot of you pay 10 cents once for an article, because they're much, much better off getting you to subscribe and get recurring revenue. And that is where they are focused. Prior to that, they wanted you to read the stuff for free so they could sell ads. They still sometimes want to do that, but that's less attractive. So it's not a tech problem. It's not trying to figure out how to pay for this or even what the Apple tax would be. It's how can a publisher be convinced that selling their stuff for 10 cents a pop is better than $10 a month? And you can work out the math for that, and it's pretty difficult. All that said, the fact that there's a consistent consumer demand for this means that we should keep trying to figure it out. A lot of people point to the success, relative success of the Apple News Plus product, which does give you access to the Washington Post and a bunch of magazines, basically for $10 a month. And so that's kind of getting at what we're talking about. You're getting access to a lot of stuff, but even there, you're paying a recurring subscription fee. That money is divided up between the various publishers, but at least they're getting consistent revenue from you, as opposed to hoping that you're going to come by and pick up an article for 10 cents. I'd also suggest that we worry about sort of what happens when people are incented to write clickbait stuff for traffic. I think if you get into a world where your success as an individual writer, reporter, or publication depends on how many people buy a particular article, that's also a problem. But people still play with this idea. They want to chase after it. There was a Dutch company called Blendl that was pitching this maybe 8 years ago or so. The New York Times and Axel Springer, big publishers, invested in that company. Mm-hmm. It didn't work, but I wouldn't say it will never work. I just think the people who suggest that they're going to bring it to you, like Elon Musk has talked about, like the guys behind Post, one of the Twitter competitors, have talked about, generally haven't sort of thought through or really talked to publishers about what's involved.
I also can't imagine that a 10 cent microtransaction, given all of the complications with like processing fees and all that, would be that appealing to
No. And also, you think about what it teaches you, right? Like, oh, a New York Times story is worth 10 cents or 8 cents instead of, oh, the New York Times is worth $15 a month. I don't think it sits well with a lot of people. Again, there are models for this. And in the old world, particularly in Europe, selling magazines on newsstands one at a time was a significant part of the business. Not so much in America, although Janice Min, who we had on a couple months ago, one of our best interviews of the year, I thought, talked about the glory days of Us Magazine, Us Weekly, where once she passed a certain number of newsstand sales, each additional magazine that she sold a la carte was worth like a dollar or something. And so they really, really racked up when you could sell a lot of things at a newsstand. But we don't live in that world anymore.
Thanks, Dario. This next question is from Michael. Peter, can you help listeners understand why RSNs, regional sports networks?
You got it.
Thank you. Went from I'm into sports. Went from seemingly such a great business. And why wouldn't they be a good acquisition target for a Netflix, let's say? It would seem to be a way to get very sticky subs without having to pay up for crazy league rights. And Mike is from Long Island.
Hey, Mike from Long Island.
In case that informs your answer.
So Mike from Long Island is talking about networks like Yes in the New York area, which is what you need to have if you want to watch Yankees games all the time. And I don't, so because I don't like the Yankees. And I was going to gas on about this, and I'm still going to gas on, but I thought it'd be also be useful if I consulted someone who actually knows what they're talking about this. So I reached out to John Arand, the excellent reporter editor over at Sports Business Journal, and asked him to weigh on this. And here is his short answer. Thanks, John. Regional sports networks face the dual problems of ever increasing right fees they pay to teams combined with shrinking distribution that affects their affiliate revenue. It's a problem that's much more pronounced at the local level than national level because RSNs have much less scale. So they're bad businesses to begin with, is what John is telling us. And then John goes on to explain that the RS business would make a terrible investment for any streamer right now, Netflix, Apple, Amazon, Google, for a lot of reasons. The most obvious is that any streaming services needs the scale of all of the RSNs. Currently, they're too spread out. Sinclair owns 19, NBC owns 7, Warner Brothers owns 3. There's a lot of individual ones. And you can see an example of a company that tried to buy a bunch of these. That's Sinclair. They bought a bunch of RSNs for $10 billion in 2019. They are now deeply leveraged and worth only a fraction of that amount. So I outsourced my answer there. Does that make sense to you, Travis, a non-sports consumer?
My boyfriend loves college sports, and he is a subscriber to ESPN plus whatever. And I'm always blown away that like any college basketball game you ever want to watch is somehow available to stream on the internet now. So yeah, I guess I have no understanding. You can cut this all out, Jelani.
I think it's useful, right? Because what ESPN did is lock up TV rights for all kinds of college sports. They have limited capacity to show all those college sports because not many people want to watch, you know, college lacrosse or whatever, but some people do. And what they found is you can take those rights, put them on the digital subscription platform, ESPN Plus, where there's an infinite amount of space. And then you get both sides of the equation. You get the high profile, high demand stuff that you can put on your linear TV channels, which reach a lot of people, that airspace is very precious. And then you can take the niche stuff, and this goes back to the niche question we had, where you have essentially unlimited shelf space, but you ask people to pay for that. So people like Travis's boyfriend who want to pay for college sports will pay up.
Yeah, see, my friends are on the other side of that, where they do watch a lot of sports, and especially like, I don't want to say extreme sports, but like they watch a lot of MMA. We watch F1. There's definitely football fans in my friends and family, but not necessarily everybody wants to pay for all those services. So they use other ways to watch them. So
we should do a piracy episode in 2023 because
that's a good idea.
It's coming back. Piracy, it's back.
Yeah, yeah. If you have an Amazon Fire Stick, you can watch anything. That's what I realized.
Jelani, I think the next question is yours.
Okay, cool. This is from Ludovic from Europe. You have strong analytical skills, a deep knowledge of the media and tech environment, as well as one of the best possible networks in the industry.
Didn't mention how handsome I am.
Did you ever consider switching sides to work on the business side? If yes or no, why not? So you can answer that first question. And then can you give examples of guests you always wanted to have on your podcast but did not accept yet?
No, I'm not really fit to do much more than what I'm doing right now, for better and for worse. Some people who, in older days when I used to spend more time like writing about startups, say, oh, you might be a good VC. And there are some crossover components to like VC and journalist. I think you do a lot of work by yourself. You're trying to find interesting people and things and learn about them and maybe tell other people about them. I would be terrible at picking promising startups and or wooing them or telling them why my company should put money in them. Yeah, and every other business job that's ever sort of come my way involves me managing people. And I don't want to say I should never manage people, but I really should never manage people. That's you guys laughing because you know. You have a sense that I have a difficulty managing myself. My wish list of guests, I've gotten really great guests. I'm really, really pleased. I got to interview Steven Soderbergh. I mean, I can't imagine that was part of my future many years ago. I would always like to talk to Stephen Colbert. I like all the comedy hosts, but he strikes me as deeply interesting and humane, and I would love to talk to him about grief and many other things. So he is right there at the top of my wish list. Who's on your wish list, guys?
Wish list? I mean, now that you're talking about Stephen Colbert, I would love for us to get like someone like Trevor Noah on, or even, I mean, we've been trying to get Quinta, so hopefully if she ever hears this, she'll come on the show. But we've had some pretty great guests. I like a lot of my favorite entertainers have been on the show the past like couple years. So kind of like my wish list has already been fulfilled. We've had Deezus and Mero. We've had Ben Schwartz, Jake and Amir. A lot of people that I grew up admiring a lot, and we were able to get them on the show. So I'm fulfilled at this point.
Happy customer.
I'd want, if Bob Chapek exit interview, I want the real tea.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things with people who run companies is, and one of the frustrations I have with interviews and this kind of format is, oftentimes you finish talking to them and it's kind of a strained interview because they're limited to what they can say. We stop recording and they go, well, what I couldn't tell you while we're recording, and then they tell you this part. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes it's why talking to people who are no longer running those companies is more interesting because they can be more expansive. So maybe we will come back to Bob Chapek at some point. We'll be right back talking to Peter Kafka afterwards for the sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline. Because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Beloved brands know customer relationships are everything. That's why over 130,000 trust Klaviyo to power smarter digital relationships across their websites, emails, SMS, and reviews. And now, there's Klaviyo AI, your guide to smarter insights, decisions, work, and results. Brands like Everyman Jack trust Klaviyo AI to personalize product recommendations that keep customers coming back. Discover Klaviyo AI at klaviyo.com/box. That's klaviyo.com/box.
Okay, and we're back. I've made Travis and Jelani laugh during the break, but I can't share that story with anyone. Travis, do we have another question?
Hey, PK, longtime listener, first-time submitter. As a media podcaster, I'm curious what media, movies, music, TV, video games were most influential to you? What are your go-tos, top tens, desert island picks, yada, yada, yada?
So most influential. I'm just thinking of authors right now for some reason, and that is Michael Lewis, who I read in college, read Liar's Poker, and it had never occurred to me at that time that you could write about business in an interesting way, and it kind of blew my little mind. And then after college, I started reading the Wall Street Journal because I had a job at a place that got the Wall Street Journal and had never considered reading the Wall Street Journal. And back in those days, this is pre-Rupert Murdoch, so it's a long time ago, the Wall Street Journal was a business newspaper, but it was also basically a magazine that came out each day. And so they would have these amazing feature stories that really were barely about business or if at all. I remember being really impressed with a guy named Tony Horowitz, who won a Pulitzer for a series where he took, the premise was, oh, jobs are coming back to America. Bill Clinton says the recession's over. These are the kind of jobs that are people were hiring for. And they were things like being, you know, a mail sorter or someone who was doing telemarketing or someone who was working at a chicken rendering plant. And he went and took all of those jobs. And it's kind of stunt journalism, but it's also not stunty at all. It's literally just doing the thing and describing what it was. And I found that really eye-opening. And I've never done anything like that, but it was always impressed me that sort of the idea of that business journalism could be much more expansive than sort of a recitation of a merger or an earnings call. And that's always been impressive to me. Yeah, I think that's what I got in my head right now.
I'm impressed that you picked reading stuff, because the question was movies, music, TV, and video games that you're like.
Said influential. So that's what I think about. I mean, I really liked Time Bandits when I was a kid, but I can't really tell you that affected my view of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of stuff is stuff that I, you know, music and movies are, you know, things that mean a lot to you when you're a teenager in your 20s, and then you kind of stop consuming new stuff, I think, for a lot of folks. So it's more of a like sort of, I don't know if it's influential. It's more of like, when did you stop consuming new stuff? That's maybe a more interesting question. I don't know if that's more interesting. Jelani, I think the next question is yours.
So this question comes from a very special guest that I'm pretty sure Peter knows. I'm going to play this.
Peter may have just sent money to.
Yeah. Hold on.
My name is Ben Kafka, and my question is, on what platform do you consume the most media?
That is from Ben Kafka.
That's from Ben Kafka, who has been on this podcast before and sent me that very earnest voice memo from the bathroom of his high school. So thanks for that, Ben.
Oh, no.
He wasn't vaping. That's That's what most kids do. Okay. All right. I am looking. This is not just top of my head. This is what Apple Screen Time tells me.
Oh, no, Peter.
I'm looking at it right now. I'm not going to tell you the total hours because those are humiliating. But by far, it's Twitter in terms of hours per week. Then there's a game called Golf Clash, which is not really a platform, so we won't count that. And then TikTok. And then iMessage, and then podcast. So while we've been declaring Twitter dead and dying, et cetera, obviously I'm still majorly addicted to it. And sadly, it is my most important platform. I would have guessed TikTok, frankly. I feel like I spend way more time on TikTok than anything else these days and have to frequently set a screen time limit so I spend less time on it. Twitter, I tried doing the same thing effectively by only being able to access it on my phone. That would slow me down, but instead I just keep my phone next to my laptop and that doesn't slow me down at all.
Peter, what is TikTok serving up to you?
Right now, a ton of soccer.
Okay.
Tons and tons of soccer. A lot of it is in Spanish because it's Argentina specific. So I just sort of get the gist of what's going on. A lot of softcore, not pornography, but edging close to it. Because the genius algorithm has discovered that I like to look at attractive people not wearing many clothes. Yeah, but it moves around. And I think, for all I talk about this all the time, for all the vaunted algorithm discussion around TikTok, sometimes I think it's much more basic than people expect. And it's like, oh, you liked watching the Sopranos clip? Here are more Sopranos clips. So there was a period where I was watching a lot of the Sopranos, like 3 minutes at a time on my phone. But that seems to have worn itself out. I watch a lot of Veep clips right now, which I do enjoy seeing.
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of That 70s Show clips right now because I liked a few. And now that's just all the algorithm is serving me.
Along it's what with, you want, Jelani. It's your untapped desires.
Along with the Jenna Ortega interviews because I watched Wednesday a couple weeks ago. So she's
I didn't know who Jenna Ortega was. Thank you for explaining that to me. Travis, what's in your TikTok?
I've got very specific people diving into pools from very high up.
How did you get on that side of TikTok, Travis?
I just watched one video got served up to me by the algorithm, and it was like, would you do this? And it's, the angle is above the person on the diving board, very, very, very high up from the pool. And then I watched it and I was like, no, I wouldn't do that. And then it served up another one. And I was, so now I just get clips of people doing crazy dives into pools.
Oh, you know who else? And then, by the way, I would watch those too. You know who I've really, who I actively seek out, but they serve them up to me all the time now is a guy. I don't know what his name is. He's anonymous, although you can see his face. It's a cook. It's a working chef who looks at other people's cooking videos and comments on them.
I follow him as well. He's
and
great.
There's a, Chef Reactions. And I followed him relatively early. And it's clear that he's a working chef who now I think has like 2 million followers. So it's getting to the point where it seems like he still has to work, but he certainly is able to make real money doing this. And it's quite interesting and moving because he's acerbic and crabby. And you can sort of see that that's a pretty accurate transmission of his personality, but he's also quite I find it quite touching that he is moved by the fact that people enjoy watching him make fun of people's food. What do we think about this mailbag experience, guys? We want to do it again?
Oh yeah, I thought it was great.
Sure.
Okay.
I love the questions people send in. Peter, can I ask you a dumb question?
Oh yeah.
Why is it called Recode?
There is an answer. I previously worked at something called All Things Digital, which Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg had started when they're at the Wall Street Journal. Eventually, Kara and Walt decided they wanted to leave the Journal. Like they had a mutual breakup with the Journal and go off on their own. And everyone who was working there came with them to start this new company. And we were trying to figure out what to call the company. And there were many bad ideas. And there were a bunch of good ideas. And it turns out
some of the original names.
I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings any more than I already have, but because they were like Tech News Today or things that sort of were literal.
Leapblorp.biz.
And I was pointing out that a lot of the names that were in circulation at the time didn't really have to do. They weren't literal explanations of what the brand was, like Quartz, which at the time was functioning. I guess it still is, or The Verge, or there was a company called paidcontent.org. And so it kind of didn't matter what you named your company, because eventually people just associated that name with the content you make, which you can see another example of that with Axios. No one would have said Axios was a good name, and now people know what Axios is. But there was a hope that we could use code as a name. And it turned out that the code URL, I'm relaying the story secondhand, so if I get it wrong, my apologies. The code.com URL was owned by the guy who made Kind candy bars. And was very wealthy.
I love that you called it a candy bar.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, I get the ones that have 6 grams of sugar or 5 grams of sugar.
Don't pretend to be a health food.
But they're a little, they're, my nutritionist said I could eat the ones that have 5 grams of sugar or less. So I still eat them, but they're candy bars. Anyway, he owned the URL and that he wanted to save that URL for some venture that was going to bring peace to the Middle East. So that code was not available. And I remember when Walt Mossberg said, well, he took me aside, said, we have the name, we've got it, we've secured the URL, it's Recode. And I said, what? Is it like Rico, like R-I-C-O-H, like the copier? Or like Rico, like the Rico Act? And Walt spelled it out for me and I got it and no one knew what it meant. And then for a while it meant a lot. And now it's probably going to mean something else. But that is the etymology of the name.
Wow, that's amazing. I did not know that. That's actually awesome.
Guys, it's been a delight working with you this year and all the years previous. Thank you. Thanks to the audience for listening. Thanks to the sponsors for bringing us this excellent episode of The Mailbag. It is the end of December. We will see you in January 2023.
Bye, guys.
Happy New Year.